Work sucks, so don't listen to anyone who says that it can be fulfilling and enjoyable. As despite what you might think, the only reason we work is for money. It's wrong to say that. We have to prioritize life over work because it is the most important thing. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Tim Duggan and Jess Brady, and we're talking about work, we're talking about life, we're talking about you, your goals, your money. And this is kind of a part two of the episode I did just last episode on FIRE, financial independence, retire early, because a lot of us want to have it all, right? I want it all, you want it all, and sometimes we can't have it all. There is that thing, it's like, if I can just have enough money so I don't have to work, or if I can just have enough money so I can have more options, if I can just have enough money, it will take the pressure off. Now, this is a part two to that episode because we really want to focus on the whole work thing, because we can be building a portfolio of assets, might be investment property, might be an investment account. But the thing is, while we're building that, the money has to come from somewhere. Usually it is from work, unless you're a trust fund kid. And I've only met one of them in the flesh, and he gets 500 grand a year after tax from the trust. So for us out there in life land, we have to earn an income. We want to build wealth. We want to do life on our own terms. We want to FIRE. We want financial independence. But there has been some changes in the way that this world operates, and we're going to talk about it today. As I said at the top, my guest is Tim Duggan, multiple author. His latest book, Work Backwards, The Revolutionary Method to Work Smarter and Live Better. And it's great to have you, Tim. Welcome.
Thank you, Glenn. It's wonderful to be here.
And Jess Brady, she is the magnificent host of the podcast, Financially Fierce. She's a financial advisor. She's a financial educator. She's an all-around good person. Welcome, Jess.
Thanks, Glenn.
And as you just heard, my name's Glenn James, and this is Money.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Now, the opening little paragraph I read at the start, it's in the front of your book, Tim, and you read it. It's like, work sucks. Yeah, that's right. Now, at the end, it says, now read it backwards. So I'm going to read it backwards because it is the most important thing. We have to prioritize life over work. It's wrong to say that the only reason we work is for money. And despite what you might think, it can be fulfilling and enjoyable. So don't listen to anyone who says that work sucks. So
I got it. I didn't get it in the beginning. I got it. Oh my gosh, I just feel like the mysteries of the universe have been solved.
Well, but Tim, the thing is, I reckon it probably works better seeing written. It does. And I can't read, so there's that.
I enjoyed when you read that the first time. I was watching Jess's face.
Yeah.
And Jess was like, hold on a second. That's not what I think. That's not what we're going to be talking about today.
Mm.
And then?
And then once you read it backwards, you realize that we are thinking about things in the wrong way.
Oh my gosh. I thought the name Hannah as an anagram was really smart. I mean, you've written a whole paragraph that you can read forwards and backwards and it coherently makes sense. Well done. But I think this is such an important conversation. And you know, to the FIRE movement, because I have very strong thoughts on it, which we may or may not get into today. One of the pieces that I think often gets missed out as well is, and this is heavy, but like we put so much pressure on this future version of us and how our life, we have to go through all this pain and we just have to put up with all of the crap because what sits on the other side is going to be this unicorn-filled destination. And what I often say to people is like, there is no guarantee that you will ever get there. And for many people, they don't get there. And I feel like that gets so missed. And I'm really excited, Tim, to hear from you and all of the amazing stuff that you've done to get the book out, because I think the sad reality is everyone's waiting to live their best life. It's probably not when you've got blue hair and can only play bingo.
I think that gets to the core of what inspired me to think about this as a topic. This is why I wrote this book. And it's because we are not thinking about this. We, most of us, and this is myself included, just get on this treadmill. And the treadmill kind of takes you from one step to another step to another step. And sometimes we get to the end of that treadmill. And for some of us, we don't. And this idea that we should always be squirreling away for a rainy day or saving something for later, sometimes there is no later. Mm. And so for me, part of the reason to write this book and to think about this was my dad, who was a huge important part of my life, passed away a few years ago. And that is a moment for anyone when someone really important to you passes away to reassess. Mm. And for me, it was a moment to reassess of, am I happy? Am I on the right path? And then started thinking wider about some of these questions. But I think you've nailed it when you say the idea of just always thinking for the future means that sometimes you are sacrificing the present. And if you do that, there's huge problems with that because we have nothing but the present.
And I think it's that contradiction and that tension point that we always talk about. And I find this really tricky as a financial advisor because it's like, where is their middle ground? Because I would say you shouldn't be reckless and crazy and not think about the future at all because we don't want you to have a longevity risk and end up in poverty. But similarly, we don't want you to hustle forever and never enjoy the sunshine or see daylight for it to not eventuate to the life that you want. And I think it's about like, you know, and I'm keen for your thoughts and I'll be quiet so we can talk about them. But like, there has to be a middle point, right?
And before I throw back to Tim, do you think it's almost akin to that? I'll give an example. People are like, I like the idea of giving to charity, right? I will do so when I earn more money. I will do so when. Now, the thing I want, and maybe you did cover it in the book or one of your previous books you wrote.
Cult Status and Killer Thinking.
That's the one. Cult Status in Red, I remember it.
Yes.
And Killer Thinking in the Light Bulb. Maybe he did cover it. But the trap, I think, could be we want to just continue to build future us and endure maybe some pain and I don't really like my career, I don't really like my job, but I know that in the future, when I get there, I will. The question is, are we in this habit because people that are, you know, about to retire at age 60 or 65, they've flicked a switch to it's like, I'm finished accumulating money. Now I've got $1 million in my super. They're not used to spending it, so they don't spend it. So I don't know. There's more of a, that's, I don't know if that's a comment or a question, but just some fodder for you to pick up on.
Yeah. And I think
that was really bad, but whatever. We'll keep it in there. I'm trying to just unpack this in real time.
Yeah. I like the discussion.
Yeah.
I think the idea of planning for the future is obviously important. And you are both financial advisors or have been at certain parts. And that is obviously really important. But I think that sometimes what can get lost is the living for the present. Mm. And part of that has to do with money. Obviously on This Is Money. But part of it also is work, as you just mentioned, Glenn, around sometimes slogging through a job that you don't love and just, oh, I just need to suck it up. And I am here to say that you don't have to just suck it up. Like, life is too short to be in a shitty job that you hate. And you don't need to love it. You don't need to be this, oh my God, I get so much meaning from my job, because not every job is going to give you all these amazing amounts of meaning. But you do and you should be able to find some elements of things that you love about your job, love about your work, people that you work with. So I just think the idea of challenging sacrifice, intense sacrifice now, is something that we don't hear that much of in the media. Mm. I think too many people are afraid to stand up and say, no, life should be really good. Your work should be enjoyable and it can be enjoyable and you should be spending some of your money on yourself right now instead of saving everything for the future.
And I think there is the difference. Like, if you're in your early 20s and you're listening to this, like, you have to do your time. You have to get qualified in your craft or, you know, if you're training to be a marketing or a plumber or an accountant, like, there is that element of you got to suck it up, do your time and get the career moving and all that. But I think it's like comes to these tipping points, like, I'm qualified at what I do. I've got lots of practical experience. I've got all these transferable skills. I hate my job. I did a reel last week. Mondays don't suck. Your life sucks. That's offensive. Okay, now can you say I'm ready to actually live? And that could be, well, I'm 28 years old. I've had enough experience to get out there and try things. I've started this. It is a different conversation for early 20s than maybe late 20s ongoing. That's kind of what I want to say. But back to, I think, you, Tim. For those who don't know your story, can you just give us the 101 background to cult status, killer thinking, and this new book, and what life looks like for you now and how you got to now? Because it is quite a unique story and encouraging.
Yeah. I never really know what to call myself now. And I think throughout my entire career, I've never really known what to call myself. I'm probably one of those, I hate the term slashy, but I like doing lots of different things.
Yeah.
I originally was in advertising and a journalist for Rolling Stone in my early 20s. I watched Almost Famous, the movie, and I loved that kid in there. And I was young and naive enough to think that you can be people in movies that you see. And so I wrote to the editor of Rolling Stone and started writing for them at a very early age. Then when I was in my mid-20s, I co-founded a national gay and lesbian website. I'd come out as gay a few years earlier. It was called Same Same. And it was, at the time, this was kind of mid-2000s, the internet was growing, communities, it had online forums, it had news and events. It was a really fascinating and important part of the internet for a lot of Australian gay and lesbian community at the time. Then the company that I co-founded that with, so it was three of my friends, there was four of us then, two left the business and two of us were left, and we launched a media publication called Junkie in 2013. And Junkie was a pop culture site for young Australians. That was really successful. The company grew then to about 60 or 70 full-time staff before we sold it in 2016 to an ASX-listed company. I hung around for 3 years through an earnout. I was enjoying it so much, I hung around for an extra fourth year. And it was during that time when all of a sudden running a business for me, when you have 60 or 70 staff and you have a lot of problems, I got into it because I loved news and journalism and content. And then I spent my whole time on cash flow, legals, HR. And then once we'd sold the company that bought us had about 800, 900 staff. They had legal teams and HR teams. And that was really amazing to be able to hand some of that off. And that was when I first then, I hadn't written in about 10 years. I was a journalist before that, then became a manager of people who wrote. And then I really reconnected with writing. And that's when I wrote my first book, Cult Status, which is all about the power of communities and how to build a really strong community around your business. That was successful enough that I wrote a second book on creativity in the workplace called Killer Thinking. And then my third book now is called Work Backwards. Mm-hmm. Part of it has been inspired by experiments on work that I've done myself. So in 2020, when I finished working, after working for 15 years building the business, my husband and I, we got married just before, we got married in March 2020. It was the...
snuck in.
We got married on a Saturday night and weddings got cancelled on the Sunday for the next year or two.
Were you the first gay wedding in Australia and then the last wedding for 3 years?
I wasn't the first gay wedding in Australia, but it was certainly the last. We were the last party on earth.
Yeah.
That's how we said it at the time.
You probably were.
Yeah. It was, this sense was building and building and building. On the Friday, we got married on the Saturday. On the Friday, it was declared the global pandemic.
Yeah.
And then everyone left to drive down. We got married in the countryside and in a couple of hours outside of Sydney. And when people left, I was just relieved because we were there. Masks weren't a thing. This was on March the 14th, 2020. Mm-hmm. So imagine that March period. So anyway, there's a side story about my husband and I getting married and having the last party on earth.
I never will not take the moment to say that your husband is Scottish.
He is Scottish. He doesn't sound like that. He's lived in Australia for 10 plus years and he's had it beaten out of him.
Don't ruin Glenn's dream. He loves
I just that. Love saying that.
Could you say any other words in Scottish?
Scottish.
So imagine him in Scotland. Imagine how annoying he'd be in goodness. Scotland.
Anyway, sorry.
That's quite funny. So that was in 2020, and since then I have experimented on myself. This book is not about me, but experimented on how to work. So for 6 months, we jumped into a camper van and we drove originally as far as we could, which was the New South Wales border because everywhere else was shut, and eventually things opened. And so we spent 6 months living and working from a camper van a couple of days a week, And then we moved to Darwin because there was no COVID there for 6 months, and we worked from Darwin for 6 months. Then came back to Sydney, and then have lived and worked as we moved around Europe. So the Greek islands and lots of different places for a year or two, trying to find somewhere to live. And then now we live in the Spanish island of Mallorca in Mediterranean.
Sounds rough.
Yeah. Where we work about 3 days a week. We work on Australian time. So kind of 6 a.m. in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. And then the rest of our time we spend eating, drinking, hiking, swimming, reading, relaxing. We don't have kids, so it's a real privilege. And that is how I have written and thought about work.
I've just got a question just for the more broader context. Was it ever public how much you sold Junkie for?
It was.
How much was that?
Yeah, so they bought 85% of the company for $11.5 million. And then they bought the other 15% of us for a couple of million more.
And is it public how much of Junkie you owned?
No.
Okay.
No.
But you did all right.
Yeah. No, it was, I'm in a privileged position because of that. I'd also, we'd sold Same Same before that to, a gay and lesbian publisher at the time. So I'd sold several businesses. And there was a bunch of different co-founders and investors in the business. But it was really set me up for life.
Yeah. And I'll always ask on this podcast, if you are new to listening to This Is Money, I'll always ask the question when I'm interviewing people, is this information public?
Mm.
And if it isn't, I won't go any further. So, yeah.
Yeah. No. Awesome. I'm super proud of everything we've built.
Yeah, it should be.
We're able to build it into a great business. And that for me has been part of my financial journey because I worked really, really hard and all of a sudden then had a windfall at the end.
Mm.
And the way that I think about money is part of what has thought about in the book, which is, I have not spent any of the money that we sold the company for.
Interesting.
Hang on. Sorry?
Yeah.
Say it again.
I have not spent any of the money that we sold the company
for. Is your head broken and do you need a hand spending some of that
Glenn's
money?
Glenn's quite good at spending money. If you need a hand, he's your guy.
Wonderful financial advisors, which is obviously very important. And they're something that I consulted when I knew this was going to happen. I had bought my house beforehand, so the size of the house that we had, and which is like a terrace in Paddington. And we...
Do you own that?
Yes.
He bought it.
No, but like, is there a mortgage against it?
There is a small one for my own purposes.
Yeah, perfect.
As in, I could pay it off,
but
for tax purposes, it's good to have. I've gotten some nods here from financial advisors, which I adore.
I think this is so interesting before we get into some of the crux of the book, because I feel like everyone that's listening would just assume you work really hard, which I want to talk more about. You get this pile of money, and then probably because everyone's fantasizing about winning the lotto every Thursday or whatever day it is, that then your life, there's a revolution and everything's different and that you just spend it all.
Mm.
And it's so beautiful to hear you be like, no, actually that's not what's happened. And, you know, you hear the stats of people winning lotto and what, 2 years later, there's nothing left.
But it's a good segue to that. You can have all the money in the world, but if you've got no purpose,
100%.
What are you doing?
So I know what my values are.
Mm.
I know what I want to do. And for me, freedom, travel, the ability to spend that time traveling around Australia in a camper van and then going to crawl through the Greek islands and end up in Mallorca. All of that is because every cent I made has been invested, has been put away in different areas, provides me passive income. I don't own a car, never owned a car or haven't owned a car in the past 10 plus years. I don't get enjoyment from those material things. And this is not to say I'm a martyr. I love having a nice house and I love beautiful things, but it doesn't really bring me that much joy. And I could have upgraded my house. I could have bought a second property. I could have done all of that. And I didn't do any of that. I just knew what I wanted the money to do for me, and it's invested. And I've watched it grow and grow and grow over the... We sold that in 2016, which was 8 years ago.
Mm.
And I've watched that grow. And that has given me way more satisfaction than shiny new cars.
Is that wealth just sitting in like an equity portfolio? Or do you buy a real property?
It's very diversified
yep.
across lots of different things.
Yep.
So my financial advisors are Minchin Moore, Yep. Yeah. If you know them.
Do.
And they've been wonderful. It's diversified across international shares, Australian, like all over the place.
Broad equity portfolio. And then it was so funny. Before we press recorded, like, is anything off limits? And he said no. So we're like, well, stuff ya.
And I thought it was going to be me who asked all the intrusive questions.
So, okay. So you said the P word, passive income.
Yeah.
Are you living off some of the income of that portfolio, or have you just not touched the capital?
No, all of that passive income gets reinvested back into it.
Awesome.
So I'm not at the stage where I want to live off that. So,
yeah. But this is the thing. You could tomorrow.
I could if I wanted to. It's for me. Do you know what gets me? Like, makes me sleep at night. Mm. Knowing what is in those accounts and knowing what is there as a backup and knowing to the cent the values of things that I have.
So
that to me is...
Yeah, this is interesting. Do you think, you know, if I was a psychologist, I'd make a terrible one, but are you working, is it a dance between the passion, something to do, and fear, or is fear actually no part of you earning an income?
No. I earn an income because I adore what I do now.
Yeah.
And I do that a couple of days a week. And so the way I earn income is I write books. I do a bit of consulting to some companies, and I kind of pick and choose. I do some mentoring for people that I can help give them some of my business journeys. Mm-hmm. And I am the chairman of a group called the Digital Publishers Alliance, which mm-hmm. is an industry body representing 50 plus of the leading independent digital publishers in the country. And as part of that, I get paid to work a day or two a week where I help advocate and support and protect our industry. And I adore all those things.
Yeah.
I wouldn't really want to do any of them full time. Mm. And that's a really interesting insight for me. I think you can overdose on too much of a good thing. But being able to spend time, so here I'm back in Sydney for a couple of weeks from Mallorca, and my time is literally split between promoting the book and then doing government advocacy work for the Digital Publishers Alliance. So on one day I'm here doing an interview, and then in the afternoon I'll go meet the assistant treasurer to talk about some big issue affecting digital publishers. Mm-hmm. So I just love that switch in between these things for me, and that to me is fulfilling. And all of this is because I've invested and saved every cent that I made through that.
So how old are you now?
43.
So you've effectively, quote unquote, fired.
Mm.
You're financially independent. You don't need an income. But you're now working because of the purpose part.
Yeah. I mean, I joked that I retired at 39.
Yeah.
Because it was before my 40th birthday. I joked because it's not retirement. To me, it was extremely fortunate to be able to take a break from the rat race and the treadmill and jump off it. Mm. And not everyone gets a chance to do that. And so hence why I wrote this book is because the book is about... not necessarily do what I do.
Mm.
You don't have to go and start a business and sell it for millions and then go live in Mallorca. That's not what this is about. It's about the fact that by jumping off the treadmill, I was able to look at it with some objectivity and then try and find, and there's like 50 or 60 different people I speak to in the book all over the world, from tradies through to bakers through to professionals who had done the same thing without the privileges that I have had.
And Tim, is this book an antidote because you personally embraced hustle culture in the past and you had, you know, we were all talk about grit and, you know, that thing that like you've got to earn your stripes and, you know, did you burn yourself out? Where did this come from?
Yeah, there's certainly an element of it. I'm fortunate to not have complete burnout.
Yeah.
But my goodness, I got close at times. And
you haven't lived, mate.
But the sad reality is so doing the research for this book was depressing at times.
Yeah.
It was genuinely sad. It was alarming.
Why?
Because the research showed that there's three main effects that work is having on almost all of us. The first one is overwork. So we are working longer hours than we ever have before. Even when we're working at home, even in the post-COVID world, Microsoft has shown that we are working on average 43 minutes a day longer post-COVID than we did pre-COVID. And that's because they track us using Teams. They used to say that we had two peaks of our day. This was on Microsoft software. That was before lunch and after lunch. And they've now tracked a third peak, which they call a triple peak day, which is after dinner. So we are working more than we ever have. The second part is that most of us are disengaged with work. So this part was like super, super depressing. The research that that I've seen on engagement at work. So the idea of quiet quitting, this is some research from, I think it was from McKinsey. I just need to double check the source of it. I think it was McKinsey, which found that something like 59% of people, and they spoke to, sorry, it wasn't McKinsey, it was Gallup. Gallup spoke to 1,000 people in 160 different countries. So 1,000 people from each country, and found that 59% of people were disengaged with work, and something like 19% of people on top of that were actively disengaged. So quiet quitting versus loud quitting. So we're talking about something like 3/4 of people being disengaged. So we're disengaged with work. And then the last one was that we are relatively apprehensive about the future. So all the research shows AI, it shows the way that we think about what's going to happen to our jobs. And something like 1/3 of Australians in a PwC report said that they were worried that AI was going to take their jobs in the next 3 years. So the research was we're overworked, we're disengaged, we're apprehensive. So all of these things, and that was from a research perspective, from a personal perspective, I have been overworked, I have been disengaged, and I have been apprehensive about where all this is going. So I think I used myself as my own personal experience, and then I used that as a way of just going in and saying, is this just me that thinks this, or is this our entire society?
And it's most people.
It is most people.
Having had a 1 second scroll at the book, because I only saw it this morning, The Upside Down Swan, what is it?
Yeah, The Upside Down Swan is a really wonderful story of a company in London called St. Luke's. And St. Luke's was an advertising agency in the early 2000s that I have rediscovered this story. I knew it at the time, and I have since spoken to the people who were there at the time. It was a company that decided to be the future of work all at once. And the upside down swan analogy comes from, they say that most companies are serene on the top, and you go in there and like, oh, this is amazing. Then underneath, their legs are going wild. And this company was the inverse. It was an upside-down swan, which meant that when you went into their office, it was loud and it was active and there was people everywhere and there's all this energy. And underneath, it was really serene because they had a real clear purpose and they had a really interesting way of thinking about business.
And presumably engagement, higher satisfaction from staff, higher...
So this company was quite progressive. So 100% of the company was owned by the staff. There was no shareholders. They did remote working before remote working existed really in the 2000s. They were completely open plan. You could sit wherever you wanted at the time. They were very, very progressive, and they were this amazing company that I think I equated them to Icarus. They kind of like flew a little bit too close to the sun and they kind of imploded about 5 years later.
Yeah, but there's a whole thing about leadership in that, you know, with everyone having a seat at the table, it's like nothing's going to get done.
Yeah, yeah. And idealism. The idealism was because they said, this is a company of the future. We're all owned, but everyone has an equal say. And then about a couple of years into it, they realized that some of the things that they had decided were incorrect. So an example was they said, no one's ever going to get bonuses. And then some people did all this work and they worked on pitches and they wanted to give them a bonus to do that. And they'd attracted all these idealistic people into it, and they said, no, 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 that's not our rules. And so they kind of got eaten by their own idealism.
Well, everything works until it doesn't, right?
Yeah. I think sometimes also, always, you need to admit mistakes and you need to keep changing direction slightly. And they were so idealistic, they had such principles that they couldn't change direction without losing face.
And I always kind of jokingly talk about, like, it's a two-edged sword with the workplace, right? One edge of the sword, it can be the nicest, eat, pray, love, fun place, blah, 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 and you're not getting paid that much, but you like it. And then, well, there's probably two swords. Then the other sword is you can be paid all the money in the world, but if it's a toxic wasteland dump, you're out of there.
Yeah.
So back to the research piece, talk to us about your time in Finland and what took you there. Was it Finnair?
I did go there on Finnair.
There you go.
Have you travelled Finnair?
No, I haven't, but I've heard those seats are really nice.
Finnair is wonderful.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're like the lounge.
Is this a sponsor?
No, no, it should be though. It should be.
Yeah, Finnair. They're like the pod seats.
Yeah, yeah. Finnair is beautiful. But Finland is really fascinating. So I became really interested in happiness at work and the science behind happiness at work, because all of these stats that I and research I was doing was essentially showing that people weren't happy and there was a lot of things wrong with the way we're working. So I wanted to, one, I spoke to experts. I spoke to a wonderful expert called Dr. Laurie Santos, who has a podcast called The Happiness Project. And it's called the Happiness Lab podcast.
I've seen that around.
Yes, yeah. It's had 100 million plus downloads.
So small podcast.
Yeah, so it's one of the biggest kind of podcasts in the world on the science of happiness. And then I kept on seeing some countries coming up over and over again in research. And particularly I looked at a thing called the World Happiness Report, which is the happiest countries in the world. And for the last 7 years, Finland has come out number one as the world's happiest country.
And it's cold there, so they're obviously doing something.
It is extremely cold. It is. I don't think we can kind of understand how cold it is.
So how are they so happy? What did you find out?
Yeah, so I spent a few weeks there, and I went to Aalto University and met some researchers and really tried to understand. And I was surprised when I got there because people didn't seem particularly happy. So walking through the streets, it wasn't like everyone was like smiling, like, wow, this is amazing. But I did more and more research. And number one was figuring out the methodology around the study. So it's called the World Happiness Report. And the question asked people is, how satisfied are you on a scale of 1 to 10, on a ladder of 1 to 10, give a number. And Finland rated the highest in that, which is not necessarily happiness.
Because what is happiness, right? Happiness is a roller coaster of like a small moment.
Totally. And, yeah. And researchers, some research I saw to ask about happiness, ask questions like, how many times did you smile in the last day? That was one way. But so really it was about satisfaction, less than happiness. And Finns are essentially satisfied people. And the reason why they're satisfied is, number one, they've got a very good social welfare system. So therefore not many people said that they were 0 to 5 on the scale of satisfaction of life. And the second one was they've got a couple of really cultures, things they do within their culture that just accidentally bring them happiness. One of those is sauna culture. So because it is very cold, something like 80 or 90% of Finns have a sauna at least once a week.
I go once a week.
There you go. Where do you go?
Oh, I go to Bionic Wealth. Oh. Hashtag Bionic Wealth.
Are you happy?
Surrey Hills. I do go to an infrared sauna.
Amazing.
It does do something to me because I'm not very woo-woo, but if I don't go, I haven't been for the last little bit.
It's a bit of a purge, isn't it?
Spiritually, emotionally, physically, and you're stuck with yourself. You know, you're in this space, and it's one of the few times I get to think.
So
you
don't have your phone.
No, you can't because it's 74 degrees.
Name somewhere else where and you can't say the toilet because we do have a phone on the toilet. But so when I was in Finland, I had a sauna once a day. We went to these saunas, and
don't you feel good. You feel sick when you first do it.
Phenomenal. Yeah. Oh my goodness. And so most Finns therefore do that. And when you do that, you're away from your phone. You are with your family and friends because people go with their friends or they go with family.
Gross.
A lot of people go completely naked. So therefore this kind of body image and things like that. Doesn't matter who you are. Everyone is sitting there naked on a towel. So the idea of hierarchy goes. Most of them are out in nature. So they're these beautiful huts next to a lake. So you're part of nature. So all of these things.
Which is what, biophilia? That's the,
I think, it is, which, and you are with your own thoughts for half an hour, 10 minutes, 1 hour. So you kind of go into meditative states. So all these things that have effect on happiness, the Finns do. But the final part and the most interesting part, which I think we can all relate to, is that they're just satisfied with enough. You drive around Finland and you don't see giant mega mansions. You don't see giant boats everywhere. You see nice houses, small, enough for people. And there's this real sense of satisfaction with their life. And that is something that I think is super important. One of the second parts of the steps in my book is around knowing what your enough is. And to bring that back to myself personally, part of the reason why I didn't need to go and spend on new cars and houses and everything is because I know what my enough is. My enough is being with my husband in a house, in somewhere traveling the world, trying new things, having enough clothes, enough all of these things that I need as I said, I'm not a martyr here. I still like the nice things in life, but I have one of them and that's enough for me. And I wear it out. And then when it's gone, I replace it with something new.
I had a similar experience. So I sold a company that I co-founded a couple of years ago. And I think my friends couldn't understand why I was still me shopping at thrift shops. You know, they were like, Jess, that bloody t-shirt has a hole in it. And I'm like, oh yeah. You know, it didn't fundamentally change me like you might expect. I don't know how, if you know how you'll behave when it happens, but I very much resonate with that. Did I go on a fancy trip? Did I buy some assets and home and everything? Yeah, sure. But fundamentally who I was and how I spent and how I thought about money didn't change, and I didn't become reckless or have this desire to do all this status symbol stuff. But it can be so easy, especially if you haven't spent time thinking about what drives you and what your personal values are.
Totally. Yeah. So in the book, I help anyone do this. And so whether you have, you know, been lucky enough like us to be able to build something and sell it, or you're just working 5 days a week and you want to be a little bit happier with work, I love acronyms. It's my favorite thing in the world to come up with acronyms, to create them, to I'm an acronym, as are you, Glenn. And
hit us. What is it?
The simple acronym is, well, if you want to know where you're going, you need a map. Mm-hmm. And so a map stands for, you need to know what meaning you get from work and outside it. You need to know what your anchors are, which is your core values, and you need to know what your priorities are in life. And as soon as you know those three things, what meaning you get from work and outside it, what your anchors are, and what your priorities are, everything then starts falling into place. And if you have a windfall, you know what the map where you want to get to. If you're working and you just want to know how to make work that slight little bit better, by knowing a map of where you're going to go, that is going to make all the difference.
Mm. I'm going to ask Tim a real tough question. Might be a bit awkward, and I'll do so right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com. Click Get Help and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Okay, we're back. Tim, I got a tough question for you. We talk about the future of work and a lot of people, they instantly think about, well, the future of work, it's working remote or it's 4-day work week. And everyone, Tim was instrumental in helping my business move to a 4-day work week. So thank you for that. And we haven't gone back. And it's cute when you talk about these flexible working arrangements, right? Wonderful. But what about the garbo? What about the cleaner? I think what I'm saying is it seems like a very white collar vibe. How does
it? Just a white vibe in general. Like,
yeah.
It is middle class.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do, like, did you touch on those more manual blue collar roles and what does the future of work look like for those people?
That is a great question. And
not even my hard question yet, but I'll
that's not the hard question.
First.
Okay. No, oh, great. You're building up to it. Okay, great. Well, it's certainly something I thought a lot about when thinking about the future of work. And I'm not Pollyanna. The future of work is going to be uneven.
Mm.
The way we're currently working is uneven, and we're not going to get to some future where, well, all of a sudden everyone can work from home and hybrid work's going to solve everything. That is not where we're heading. So based on research, about half of all workers are professional white-collar workers and about half of all workers are blue-collar workers. And even jobs that you think are traditionally tied to a location, like a nurse. You think a nurse has to be at a location. They need to be at a hospital or wherever they're doing their nursing work. Research showed that even jobs like that tend to have about 20 to 25% of their job that can be done from another location. So if you are a nurse, you still have to do your scheduling. You still have to do paperwork. You still have to do invoicing. You still have to do research. So whilst the future of work is not going to be even and not everyone will be able to work remotely from Mallorca and do what they want to do, even people who traditionally are tied to a location, a teacher, can hopefully still be able to use some of these tools.
But the problem is it's so systemic. A nurse listening or a teacher listening will be like, that's funny, try and change that. Like, it's so systemic, right?
It is, but this is the moment to kind of try to change that. And I agree with that. I think pre-2020, in 2019, if we were having this conversation, I'm happy for a nurse or a teacher to laugh at me.
Yeah.
Now, I want a nurse or teacher to look at these tools and say, hold on a second, maybe I can use that one and start a conversation at their workplace about it.
Mm.
Because, Tim, what do you think happens if we don't?
If we don't, if we continue on the same path that we're on, I'm really concerned for the future of our society. I am concerned that inequality is only going to get larger and larger and wider and wider. I'm concerned that all those negative things I spoke about earlier, burnout and apprehension and overwork, are just going to get worse and worse because the numbers are going in one direction only. They're not changing. So something, one of the lines in the book is that something is going to break soon. And if we don't change, it's going to be us.
We're at breaking point.
We are at breaking point.
Mm.
Yeah, we really are. And the of course, a book is about simplifying complex things. And so in my simplified way of talking about this, it's we are going in the wrong direction. We need to change direction and go back the other way. Because if we don't, where will, at the moment, a UK study by Pew Research showed that something like 1 in 3 UK adults had experienced burnout sometimes, often, or always in the last month.
Hmm.
1 in 3.
And the irony, or the bullshit bit, is that everyone's so burnt out and they're working so hard that they don't have the time, effort, or inclination to actually take those proactive steps to design the life that they want, or even, for God's sake, start thinking about the life that 100%. They want. And so people are in this quagmire and they don't know how to move forward.
Totally.
And so is there something that they can do to be like, because if you're burnt out, you know, how do you start? Where do you start?
Yeah, I know this is not just a plug for the book, but you need to do something that's going to break you out of that. And in this case, grab the book, read the opening chapter, go to my Substack and read the opening chapter on there. I kind of, you don't need to necessarily buy this. And I genuinely mean it's not a plug for the book, but you need to do something that breaks you out of that. And that might be listening to this podcast. It might be talking to a friend. It might be
take some action
and just realize that the path that many of us are on is unhealthy.
And also, I think, and this is sometimes seen as aggressive, you're responsible for your life.
Mm.
Like, I also think that we abdicate from responsibility, like everything will just sort itself out and we're on that treadmill that you're talking about. Like, it's not anyone else's responsibility to come and save you. You are responsible for yourself and you're responsible for the decisions that you make. And sure, life throws you curveballs and shit sandwiches sometimes, but ultimately, like, who are you waiting for? Because they're not coming. It's time to figure out how that looks for you.
Totally.
Is that awful?
No.
Well, it goes back to this, for some people, it just is harder and it just takes longer. Like, if you're in a situation that's no fault of your own.
Of course.
You might be in debt due to some accident that you had to pay for and your insurance or some mess. It's like, well, I can't quit tomorrow because I've got all this consumer debt. But it's like, how can we look forward? And you're saying, all right, I can't do this tomorrow, but in 3 years, I'm not going to be where I am today. It's going to take longer, but I'm committing to this. I'm keeping accountable. I'm going to be active to life. I'm going to happen to life, not let life happen to me.
Yeah.
And there are going to be people listening to this who won't take any action and will just keep doing what they're doing. That's fine. But for those who actually do want to change or double down on what they're doing, this is the encouragement and this is the book that you need.
Yeah. I also think that just building on that, what you were saying, everyone's path is completely unique in this.
Mm.
And there's not one sole answer that is, this is what you should do. Because what Glenn should do is different to what Jess should do, different to what Tim should do. Completely different. So everyone, I think, is approaching this in a different way. Everyone has their own challenges. But everyone can have a common vision of where we want to get to. And that for you is figuring out where your map is and where you want to head to. And as long as you know where you're going, that you're going to be better off today knowing where you're going than if you are just like mindlessly following.
But in tandem or in concert with that, you need to know where you are as well.
Completely, mm. Yeah.
And that's not being in denial. It's like, yeah. No, you have debt, you need to pay it off. No, you're overspending, you need to stop that.
Yeah. It's the ostrich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my hard question for you, like it's all well and good. We're talking to some dude who lives in the Mediterranean and, you know, he's awesome and got no problems and all that. In your book and in your research, like you said, you talk to butchers, bakers, candlestick makers, all that.
Yeah.
What about those who might be a primary caregiver and have the special K, not that special K, but like kids?
Yeah.
How does that fit into this?
Yeah. And it was a big part of the book.
Right.
So both consciously and then it just kept on bubbling up. So consciously, when I write my books, I try and have as close to a 50-50 gender balance as possible of guests that I speak to. And sometimes that is hard because sometimes there's really loud male voices in research or in certain fields that you need to counterbalance. So I started speaking to a lot of really accomplished, smart female scientists, researchers, people who had been thinking about this for a long time. And I was speaking to them on, you know, about their topic. And so I would call them up and I'd say, hey, let's talk about all the research you've done in this space. And then more often than not, we'd start getting into personal stuff and I would always talk about the research and ask questions around, so how do you balance your work with your life because this is quite hard? And then almost all of them would then start talking about, oh, well, I have three kids under five. I have a daughter and this changed for me when I had a daughter. And a couple of insights came up from that. Number one was that a lot of working parents said they had this kind of idealized version of what they thought it was going to be and about how to balance their life. And then kids came along and, you know, they really learned the hard way around how to do things. And in particular, a lot of things that we talk about in the book, like flexible working and remote working and all these things, have been pioneered by working mothers for decades.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to talk about how to flexible work? Go and talk to your mum.
Mm.
That's what our mothers have done when they went back and they didn't have all this support. They didn't have books telling them how to do it. They didn't have bosses that were trying to help them catch up with what they're doing while they've been away. They didn't have Slack to help them. So I think primary caregivers have become a real big theme throughout the book because I haven't done the maths on it, but I reckon that something like about half of all the people I spoke to brought up kids and how to manage kids with all of this idealized version of living.
So we need a revolution, by the sounds of it.
We do.
So that we don't.
Are you with me?
I am with you. If you do a protest or something, can you let me know? I quite like going to protests that I stand
would,
up for.
Yep. She would.
Can you help make
lives
the signs?
Lives in a little Surrey Hills and
I'll make a sign.
A protest.
I'll bring the snacks. I'll corral people. I'll be an ally. I love this. But I think we do need, I mean, all of the research is glaringly obvious. We're just so tired and sick probably that we can't see the forest from the trees. So I'm with you. What responsibility do leaders and companies have to pioneer this? Because if we've been doing more with less forever, and it sounds like we've hit into the muscle, there's no more fat, it's clear to me that this is not just a thing that I can fix independently and that you need support from people above you. So if people are listening and they are leaders, what do they do?
Yeah, great question. If you're a leader or the owner of a company or the CEO or the head of a department, you have spent years most likely getting to that position and you've spent years within the system that has existed. So you know and you think, of course we need to work 5 days a week in office because that's what I did and that's what my boss did and that's what my boss's boss did. So the one thing that I think that leaders need to do is to be open to all of these new opportunities and these new tools out there.
Mm.
Because I'm having a lot of conversations, particularly with C-suite level, with people at the top of organizations, and almost all of them have really burnt in opinions, and it's based on their own beliefs.
I hustled to get here and sacrificed everything, therefore you will too.
You're going to come into the office 5 days a week because that's what I did. Mm. You want to get a promotion, you need to be sitting next to me. Mm. And so the challenge that I have is that if someone listening to this that sounds like you have really been open. And an example of that is the whole four-day work week revolution. As part of this book, I did some experiments with Glenn and the Simo team. I worked, I spoke with a guy called Andrew Barnes, who was he calls himself the global architect of the four-day work week movement. And he is.
Good title.
Amazing title. Mm. Global architect. Mm. I love that.
I'm a global architect of BS.
And Andrew is. He's amazing. He has had a company in New Zealand called Perpetual. And they went to a four-day work week in pre-COVID, maybe I'm trying to think of the exact date, say 2015, 2016. And he really pushed it through the board, who didn't want to do it, the senior management, who didn't want to do it. Anyone, like all the staff were kind of like, let's experiment, see what this is. And it was so successful that he then announced to the world, hey, I've done this and it's been amazing. And it kicked off the four-day work week kind of global movement. And I remember sitting down with him and asking him around the insights of, you know, what should managers do. And some of his things that he was saying were things like, one, you need to be open to it. Two, you need to co-create this with your staff. So this also shouldn't be something that just comes from the top down and CEO or leader comes in one day and says, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. You need to get everyone on board. And things like four-day work week, which some people are closed to, and of companies that have experimented with four-day work weeks, 93% of them have continued the experiment after it's finished. So they've changed.
Wow.
Almost permanently. It's only been a couple of years, so I couldn't say permanently, but they've changed how they work. And the effect of that on the company, on the people who work there, we're still finding out that, they said, this is a newish movement. It's been around for, you know, properly for 5 or 10 years. But the fact that companies are changing and not turning back, to me, says it's a one-way street. And I predict that almost all of us as a society will and should be working a four-day work week within the next 20 or 30 years.
Is it bad that I've just been sitting here thinking, shall I move to a four-day work week? Could I have my team do 4 days? I think I need to go and do some more. I mean, I'm a leader. I have a responsibility to think about this stuff.
I mean, it can be done. I did it. And I hate change.
You do. You're a little bit hesitant to it at the start. You thought that your staff were going to take the 4 days off and you would just take the Friday and you would just work through just without anyone to annoy you.
Yeah. Which I do sometimes, but primarily, but what it did, it actually changed. If I'm speaking to other business owners here, it actually can cull a heap of fat. Like, as part of this 4 day work week thing, we ditched the Monday morning meetings. Like, why were we doing that? How's everyone's weekend? Yeah, sweet. If you want to have meetings within your own teams, knock yourself out. But we just didn't have the time anymore because we had to get into the work.
Mm.
And for me, it really made me as a business think about efficiencies and doing things better. And, you know, at the end of last year, I did that TAFE course. For the last 6 months of last year, I was probably working 2 or 3 days a week. Like, it can be done.
Yeah.
But like you kind of said, ask a single mum, for example, about productivity. They'll tell you.
100%.
If there's a pinch, you can get it done and it feels more rewarding at the end. And for me as a business, I think it is more so, you know, there's lots of benefits. It really is a good employee benefit, particularly at the moment because not many other businesses are doing the four-day work week.
Yeah.
Rach in the team, she's been really maximizing it, and she can edit this out if she doesn't like me telling it. But, like, she will book annual leave either side of long weekends, so she might have a five-day mini break every quarter or something like that. So really maximizing the use of that. So,
and the benefits for that. So the whole thing is, who are we when we're outside of work?
Yeah.
So Rach, when she's outside of work, is spending time with her loved ones, doing things she loves, exploring. I'm putting words into your mouth here, Rach, but
yeah,
that's what she would be doing on that time. And the thesis, and this is still something that needs to be proven, is that when you do that, you are then a better employee during the hours that you are working. And so far, and I say thesis because this thing will be proven, you know, long term when we're talking about everyone moving to it. Mm. But so far, all the signs are that productivity doesn't get really hit. There's probably 20% of guff in a day that can be cut without it affecting too much and without affecting too much of all the positive things that you get from work.
And you've got to look at it like, thousands of years ago, and I'm terrible at theology, but like, for example, you would work 7 days a week as a slave, for example, right? Or most people work 7 days a week. The Ten Commandments came in and it was revolutionary because it talked about a Sabbath, having one day off. Mm. It's like, what? We get one day off? That's awesome. Like, so it's this cultural norm that has been so long that we've worked 7 days a week. Can it be real that we get one day off?
But it was a subsistence, right?
Yes.
Like there was a true survival component to that because you needed to go and hunt, otherwise you didn't feed your family.
Yeah, but all the concepts that we're living with now are all completely man-made and made up, and they've all been fought for. Mm. So workers have fought for a 5 day, you know, 6 day week, and then a 5 day week. And I think now workers should fight for it, but I also think employers should fight for it as well because I genuinely think it's just as important for the business and longevity and keeping and retaining staff.
On that, someone's listening, they're an employee, and granted, there are people, they live among us, that will never run their own business or be a CEO. You know, not everyone does everything, so there are people that are happy with their job. Hmm. I know lots of them, lots of you listen, happy with your job, happy with work, but you might be the only one in your team or business that listens to such controversial content like this and such rubbish podcasting of the Glenn James ilk. How does that employee, because they're inspired, they're listening to this, how do they run these ideas up the flagpole?
So employees have more power right now.
Join a union.
Then employees have more power right now than they ever had before.
Yeah.
So that tension where in 2019, employers had almost all the power. Mm. This is where you're going to work. This is the hours you're going to work. This is how you're going to work. You need to be in this city, in this town, in order to get a job with me. COVID, that power went to employees and employees said, I'm not going to come into work today because I don't want to catch the bus because I worry about sickness. I'm going to work from home. And obviously COVID forced them to do that. It wasn't just employees deciding to do that. Mm. And now there's this tension between the two, but we're still in this amazing period where employees have power. And the way that you have power is that you understand, you read books like this, you read research and you find out who is doing stuff. You take some of that to your boss. So have a conversation. Talk to somebody and see if somebody's willing to talk about 4 day work weeks or 9 day fortnights or flexible work hours or remote working. In 2019, all of this was kind of a bit hypothetical. You couldn't really go to your boss and say, I want to work from home 2 days a week. What do you say about that? You probably wouldn't have a job the next week. Whereas now you can have this conversation and all workplaces are having this conversation at some stage.
So in terms of the practical approach, it's probably you need to know the bigger your business is, the longer it might take and the harder it might be. So I think it's that dance. It's like if I work for a top 200 company and it's old school, bums on seats, 9 to 5, you might actually be wasting your energy. Or do you go, look, I want to run this up the flagpole, try and talk to my managers, see if they can talk to their leaders. But it's just, I think there's, what I'm trying to say, it could be a long game, but if you're in a smaller business and there's 30 or 40 people, can you have a coffee with the leadership team?
Totally.
Or, I think, just like, hey, I'm reading this stuff. I know money's tight, but could there be other ways that you can entice us as workers?
Totally. And I think all of these need to be co-created. And so what that means is that you need to work with everyone, all agreeing on what the aim of doing this is. When you've got a small company, that's easier because you can get everyone probably in a room. Mm-hmm. When you've got a big company, that's harder. But the benefit of being a big company is you probably have entire areas, HR areas that might do change management and might look at things and might say, yeah, let's do an experiment on one part of the business and see what happens.
Because it's probably a bigger thing if if you got legitimate feedback to make the place better and it doesn't want to be heard, there's a bigger problem anyway, maybe.
Yeah. Sorry, I thought there was
something to say. No, we just kind of hit a brick wall. But I think within all that, you mentioned some of them before, and I really struggle with this, you know, because I basically said to you at the time, I'm like, I don't want my team logging in working at 10 p.m. Mm. And you said, well, hang on, that might actually suit them better. They've put the kids to bed. They've done this. So that's potentially a tool, that flexible work. So
yeah,
it's not all four-day work week. It's not all working remote. It's not all this. It could be a blend or
one. And all these things are tools.
Yeah.
And tools are designed to be used and experimented with, and they should be fit for purpose. And there's times when you use one and you realize, oh, that's no longer effective. I'm going to use something else. Mm. So flexible working, remote working, hybrid working, even things like artificial intelligence, all these things are tools to be used by us at different stages of our career. And just because we're using it today also doesn't mean it's the right tool. So just because you moved to a four-day work week doesn't mean for the rest of your life Simo Interactive is only ever going to be a four-day work week.
Mm.
It works now.
We might go to an eight-day week.
I think that's just really important to think that nothing is final and it shouldn't be.
Tim, what is your hope for the people that read the book?
I want people to read this and recognize something inside their minds that they have been thinking about but maybe haven't been able to articulate. So I want people to read this with an open mind. I want someone to read it and feel like, that is me. This is me. I think that there is more out there. I think that potentially I don't want to go down this path of burnout and overwork. What is the solution to that? So that's what I want. I just want people to be open-minded. I don't want to say everyone has to use it. If you do, there's 10 exercises throughout the book. You can download worksheets, use it. But I think the first step is just be open-minded.
We'll put a link in the show notes to purchase the book. And there is also an audio book, which I would encourage you to do that as well. If you do listen to audio content, there's an audio book. If we swing it right back to the front where we talked about this financial independence, retire early, like I need to have enough money to escape what I'm doing. When I did the last episode and I talked about this, I think this book will really help you because I said one option could be, well, if you want to get to the stage where I want more freedom in my life and, you know, because a lot of the quote unquote FIRE movement is around removing yourself from the consumerism and knowing what you want and, you know, what's enough. Can you design your life and be okay with, you know what, I just work 3 days a week?
Yeah.
So, and you're going to cop it from society or your in-laws and outlaws. They're going to be like, he needs to get bloody, she needs to get bloody, get to work. How can they work 3 days a week? Because that could be the answer to what you're so hard working for, working 5 days a week. So in 10 years, I can have, or 20 years, enough money to stop working and work's optional. But because I'll get bored, I'll end up doing some type of work. Just bring it all forward now and do what I like to say, my acronym, LOOT, life on own terms.
Yeah, like, I love that.
Work 3 days a week. Work an 8 day fortnight or whatever. I don't know. Get creative. Society is going to come at you. You've got to be brave enough to say, I'm on this speck of dust in the middle of nowhere for a minute. You know, if you look at infinity, so to work out 10 divided by 100, that's 10%, right? So if you're alive over a 100-year period for 10 years, go with me, people, you're alive for 10% of that allotted time, right? Yeah?
We have no idea what you're talking about. We keep going.
Of the infinity time?
Yeah.
No. So, but then if you go 80 years life expectancy divided by infinity doesn't compute.
Nothing.
You're not here, people. Life's too short.
I'm with you.
To dick around not working 3 days a week. For society, no one cares. Everyone's going home tonight thinking about their own problems anyway.
100%.
You do you.
I think that is just such a important point, which is We've got one life.
And we're not here for long.
We're not here for long. And if we don't take control of it, then we're just going to float along. We'll get there. I talk about death a lot in this book because it bookended by my dad's death at the start, and then at the end I go back to a deathbed. And thinking about when you're lying there on your deathbed, are you going to be worrying about the work you did or how hard you worked or those emails or all those that really interesting late nights that you put in there? Or are you going to care about your friends, your family, the things you did, the love you made, the love you left? That is way more important than work will ever be.
I think as someone who has hustled like the best of hustlers to build businesses and who has burnt themselves out, I've been through massive burnout, and I justified it because there was all these success markers that the world had told me meant that everything was good, even though I felt really shit inside. I wish I had read this years ago. I wish there was more conversations about this, and that this, the way that we're living now, it doesn't need to be the way, and it's not the only way. Thank you. I can't wait to go to the local bookstore, which we've discussed has the book. So I'm going to go and get it and read it.
Yes.
I found this very insightful, and I've got some ideas about how I want to make some potential changes.
Amazing. That's the whole point of this book.
Have you read the book yet, Tim?
And in finishing, is there anything that I like to ask that we didn't ask you or that you thought would have been a value to add to my audience on your way here today?
No, I think we had a really wide-ranging conversation, and if this book can spark thoughts inside your brain on maybe I should try that, or how do I do that, or is this a new idea, job done. That's it. And so hopefully not even just the book, I think even this podcast.
Yeah. So if you have found this useful today, please forward this to your manager, forward it to a friend, forward it to a family member. Remember, for something to change, get this, people, something has to change. It's as simple as that. It takes risk, it takes guts, it takes encouragement, and we want to be that encouraging voice, because I just can't stress it enough. Your family, your friends, your colleagues, when you propose some of this stuff, like I'm living in a four-day work week, my team are, it's normal to us. They talk to their other friends and family, they can't believe, they get, what, you just can't compute. It's going to come thick and fast, but we are here to say you're not crazy. Like, it's actually okay to live a life that you want on your own terms.
Totally. That's confronting to some people. I think that's why if you say to somebody, I'm working a four-day work week, and someone is not, that says more about the other person and how they feel about their job.
That's right. So you can get the book Work Backwards where any good books are sold. In fact, Jess, this is the second copy that I've got. I bought it last night at the book launch. I want to give this to you.
And I'll even sign it for you, Jess.
No, it's signed.
Oh.
Maybe you could write her name in it.
Yeah, I'll write your name in it. I'll personalise it to you.
Oh my goodness, team. This is great.
And so I've got the... I just forgot my copy.
Thanks. Thanks, Glenn. That's very kind of you. I think gifting books is like the best thing you can ever give someone.
It's a good gift that you can give to anyone.
Give everyone books.
Let us know what you think about this in the Facebook group, This Is Money. You can hear Jess Brady on the Financially Fierce podcast. You can listen to Tim on the audiobook of Work Backwards.
You can,
read the book. You can follow him on Instagram, Tim Duggan. Thank you so much for popping in and being part of our world.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Tim. It was great.
Bye.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work, and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. If you are interested in furthering your education around money, your career or property, we have three books that might help. Check out Sort Your Money Out, Sort Your Career Out and Sort Your Property Out. Find these wherever good books are sold or via the link in the podcast show notes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Simo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Mom Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.